KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in False Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
Welcome to the Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature and the human heart.
It's all alive. It's all connected. It's all intelligent. It's all relatives.
It's a battle of stories. And we have this story over here that says, I alone can fix it. This story over here that says, we don't have enough, that we should fear one another, that the only way to exist is on top of someone else, to dominate and extract and destroy in order to exist. But here's what they don't know. We here, we earthlings, we people who believe in the full spectrum of life understand the full power of fire. To cleanse, to renew, to lay ground for a forest to grow. Stronger than before.
We hitch a ride with the comedian, writer, futurist, technologist, and storyteller Baratunde Thurston. Like so many stories, his story began with a journey. But in this case, the journey was storytelling. As human beings, our brains are hardwired for stories and metaphor. At this perilous existential threshold that will determine the fate of the human experiment, Baratunde knows that the story of the battle is equally the battle of the story. I'm Neil Harvey. This is Declarations of Interdependence, a story of storytelling.
I want to tell you a story, because that's what I do. I try to weave stories of interdependence through our relationships with Earth, with each other, and with technology. And that's important now more than ever because we are in a crisis. In fact, it's so big, people are calling it a poly-crisis. This is a crisis that can't commit to just being one crisis. It's a crisis in an open relationship. You got a democracy crisis, entangled with a climate crisis, entangled with an economic crisis and a technological crisis. And there is another crisis, and that is the overuse of the word crisis. It's a serious crisis, and I'm proud to be brave enough to name it. You're welcome.
As a storyteller, Baratunde Thurston has been nominated for an Emmy and has worked for The Daily Show. He's the host and executive producer of the PBS TV series America Outdoors. He's co-creator and host of two podcasts, How to Citizen and Life with Machines. His comedic memoir, How to Be Black, was a New York Times bestseller. He first developed his stand-up comedy shortly after graduating from Harvard. Since time immemorial, storytellers have held an exalted role in human societies, because stories illustrate parables that both make sense of the world and help us survive. As the writer Ferris Jaber wrote in The Story of Storytelling, quote, in many ways, stories are uncannily similar to living organisms. They were simulations that allowed our ancestors to develop crucial mental and social skills and to practice overcoming conflict without being in actual danger. A story is really a way of thinking, perhaps the most powerful and versatile skill in the human cognitive repertoire.
My name is Baratunde Rafiq Thurston. When we speak our names, we speak our ancestors who spoke us into being when they named us. I was born and raised in Washington, D.C. I am the son of Arnold and Arnita,
who were both born and raised in Washington, D.C. My mother, the daughter of Homer and Lorraine, who were both born and raised in Washington, D.C. My father, the son of Leon and Dora, who were both born and raised in Orangeburg, South Carolina. And so we've arrived at our first lesson about the limitations of autocomplete and pattern recognition as a substitution for intelligence. Some of the best patterns are the ones we intentionally break. My mother is a powerful force of nature, born into a story too small to contain her full nature, her spirit. Born in 1940 in these United States, born to a family that told her she was too black and too dumb to amount to anything, into a nation that didn't have space for a woman or a black person as big as she was. But she found a way toward liberation through a more expanded story, through her relations with her own grandparents who loved nature and the outdoors, and she would spend good time with them out on the land. She found herself in a community of Pan-Africanist radical people trying to reform a sense of self and identity to love themselves. She found herself as a computer programmer in the early 1980s for the federal government. When you have a mother like this, that well of beautiful, pure water, it flows right down into me. My mom put me in this Boy Scout troop, all-black Boy Scout troop, put me in a rites of passage program run by these West African-inspired Afrocentric people. Basically, I was in a Wakanda sleeper cell. And I am not even joking, y'all. We got a meeting later today. You know who you are. She would take me on these camping trips and biking trips and fishing trips with my little friends. She would take me to community meetings and political rallies and cultural events so I could feel who we are as people together. She would liberate excess inventory of technology from her job. Bring a computer home so me and my older sister Belinda had a taste of the future before most people even knew. And when she sent me to private school, she gave me this bumper sticker. It said, "Question authority." She said, "You should put this in your locker." And I did so without question. Now you know something about her and something about me. One of the greatest gifts my mother gave me was to plant a seed in the form of a question. She gave me an extra homework assignment. I was no more than 12 years old when she said to me, "I want you, and by extension my older sister Belinda, I want you to come up with a system we will live under after democracy and capitalism have failed." What? I had just started sweating from my armpits at that age. I got nervous feelings in my chest when girls were too close. I was not prepared for this homework assignment. So I set it aside, thinking I had discarded it, only to discover later it was a seed planted, and my own journey through life to find bigger stories of who we can be would water that seed, and it would start to sprout so beautifully.
That seed unfolded into a story of storytelling. Again, Baratunde Thurston.
There are three narrative universes I want to take you through that have shown me what we already know, that we got this, because we always have. In 2020, my wife Elizabeth and I started a podcast. You may have heard I like those. Called How to Citizen. Citizen is a verb. We have a valuable use for it as a noun, but that is a separating function. The verb is an invitation to function. to practice. And we started this journey and we uncovered, it was revealed to us, I will say, four principles of what citizen as a verb practically means. Four things. Number one, show up and participate. Assume there's something for you to do. Number two, understand power. Just the ability to get somebody to do what you want them to. It could be physical, financial, gathering ideas. It could be attention. Where you give your attention, you give your power. Right now, I'm the most powerful being in this room. But my power is also what I choose to do with it. Number three, to citizen is to commit to the collective, not just the individual self, which is made easier when we conceive of ourselves as more than just ourselves, where we take the advice of our very first guest, Valerie Kaur, who wrote the seminal book, See No Stranger. A stranger is just a part of myself I do not yet know. We can still be selfish so long as we expand the self, which leads to the fourth principle. To citizen is to invest in relationships with yourself, with others, and with the planet around you. Because we've been lied to, told we're separate from all these things. We're just one thing. So we found beautiful stories exemplifying this because I was tired of the story that said, we're just divided, we're just dysfunctional, we can't get anything done, and that is not the world from which I come.
That theme of interdependence began to take center stage in Baratunde's work. After all, what you appreciate appreciates, and stories can quickly take on a life of their own.
So we talk to people you may have heard of, like Jose Andres. The surface story is, oh, Jose Andres is out here running around the world feeding people after disasters. No. He is out here and his team is out here with a process that unlocks the local foods and the local cooking capacities from the food truck operators and the restaurateurs and the mamas and the aunties who feed themselves. That's the story. We heard the story of the East Bay Permanent Real Estate Cooperative right around here. Shout out to the East Bay! Creating their own housing for the businesses that they choose, meeting their own needs. We heard the story of a radical politics without politicians. That sounds tasty. An ancient tradition, it turns out, of citizen assemblies. Spoke with Claudia Qualitz from Democracy Next, who reminded us of this old school way of conscripting people into public service. That's the most representative system there is, a random allotment and sortition of everyone there. Not just the folks who raise their hand, the extroverts who like to see themselves on stage. There is wisdom in every crowd. We met fellow travelers along the way, the Adrienne Marie Brown. John Alexander was a fellow traveler we met, all the way, ironically, from England, helping a citizen here in America. Has a beautiful book, Citizens, and a framework for the stories that we are moving through, a subject story, where a single source tells you what to do, a consumer story, where we get to choose from choices that we didn't choose, to transact our way into community is a dead end. The citizen story, where the answer lies within, the world's within, all of us. Taking on challenges so big, no one entity or person or party could solve it. So I felt really good about the How to Citizen joint. I was like, we solved the democracy thing, but America kept Americaing. So I went outside. I got invited to host America Outdoors with PBS. And y'all, I got to see America and America. And they're both beautiful. I got to spend time with people connected to this land. Literal common ground under our alleged divisions. I went to a town called Elaine in Arkansas, site of one of the most violent and deadly racist massacres in U.S. history that most of us have never heard of. But I went there with a multiracial bicycling group called BikePoc. Get it? It's in the name. The railroad tracks that had brought such devastating, violent destruction at the end of a Gatling gun, mowing down farmers and their wives and their children for standing up for their rights, those tracks had been converted to a bike path, and we rolled deep in our multiracial joy, healing ourselves and the land in the process. We met the very first black mayor of this town ever who's changing that story. What do we do with the histories we inherit that don't feel good? We can metabolize them. We can.
When we return, Baratunde Thurston's storytelling journey takes him across the Great Divide through the country's heartlands. Along the way, he discovered the ancient Native American roots of American democracy that flourished 1,000 years before the first Europeans arrived. I'm Neil Harvey. You're listening to The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature. You can explore more Bioneers radio programs, podcasts, and videos online and learn about the National Bioneers Conference at bioneers.org or call 1-877-BIONEER. As Baratunde Thurston crisscrossed the country, hunting and gathering the American story, he experienced the postmodern ground truth of the poly crisis.
I spent time on the South Fork of the Salmon River with Shoshone Bannock people, the salmon people. We showed up to do a salmon hunt, but the salmon decided not to show up. Because we had turned the temperature up on their home or cooking them in their very home, and the spirit that we felt from the people when we arrived was of mourning. The loss of their siblings who had provided so much throughout their history. I felt this feeling mirrored in one of the most conservative places I ever visited, Tangier Island, Chesapeake Bay, where the mayor of that town nearly broke down in tears because he had to exhume his own ancestors and move them to higher ground because that island is about to disappear due to rising sea levels. United in a story of grief and kinship across alleged divides. I felt this common lesson, this beautiful privilege to engage with the nations within our nation. We did a story about Death Valley, which is really Tim Bisha. It's called Death Valley because some white folks back in the day didn't pack right. They should have called it We Didn't Prepare Valley. We misunderstood the assignment, Valley. Everywhere I went, from explicitly and implicitly indigenous people, I kept hearing the same refrain. Dudley Edmondson said it so well. We are not apart from nature, we are a part of nature. I felt my own kinship with trees, trees that have been weaponized against people like me, conscripted into violence through the series of lynchings. We never think about what we've done to them as well. To recognize that a tree is more than just timber, to be mined, a product to sell, but our lungs beyond our bodies helping us breathe. Which makes me want to take a big inhale, because ChatGPT? I remember where I was when that got dropped on our heads. Do you remember where you were when
ChatGPT in our feeds and our headlines, the odds are you were on the toilet. So, being the podcast fiend that I am, my wife and I were like, let's make another show. Life with Machines. Exploring the human side of this AI moment. We are invoking and creating a new population of synthetic beings when we are out of balance and right relations with our fellow human beings and the earth beneath our feet. Which presents an opportunity. We could double down on the colonial mindset, on the extraction, on the buy, 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 and the sell, sell, sell. Or we could tell ourselves a different story of using these technologies to deepen our humanity. Seneca scholar John Mohawk had been invoked once on this stage already. A longtime advisor to this very community wrote of liberation technologies, those that free us from multinational corporations, those that are built by, of, and for the people. They're FUBU technologies, for us, by us. They come from a local place, solve problems defined by the people themselves. We could do that right now, and I've seen hints of it. We talked to the Earth Species Project, literally using AI to listen in to whales. Whales have a group chat. It's lit, yo, you have no idea. The Climate Trace Project, using AI to spot climate criminals all over the world and measure emissions even when people don't want you to. To shift our energy use to the things that are good for all of us. We could even apply AI to help us connect better to ourselves, to upgrade our social technology of so-called democracy and bring it into the fold like those people in Taiwan. Audrey Tang has told the story well. We can have a more fluid collective intelligence that allows us to see what we have in common, not just what separates us, but we must choose this future.
For Baratunde, choosing the future that elevates what we have in common opened windows to the distant past. He fell upon an ancient Native American history of democracy that influenced the founding of the United States. It's the story behind the story most of us have been taught. That history of the Haudenosaunee Six Nations Confederacy would become his next podcast in progress, Project Interdependence.
Now, I thought the stories were going pretty good, but there was something gnawing at me, a missing piece. As we were winding down the podcast phase of How to Citizen, we knew that there was a story of peace, of democracy right here on this land. Heard the echoes of the words Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Literally had reached out to a man named Chief Orrin Lyons to bring him on the show. Didn't hear back, though. He's busy. So we moved on, and then as my friend C. Lai says, sometimes you gotta trust the timing. 1 year ago, almost to this day, a group of us, roughly 12, invited into deep relational community with elders from the Haudenosaunee Confederacy to sit and exchange, to hear and feel the deep truth that only an oral tradition can communicate. It is the closest thing to time travel, to hear people speak of their time immemorial practices, of the pre-existence of a confederacy of many nations before this nation was ever born. And the colonists and the settlers found it when they arrived, and they studied and were influenced. Many hands making this soup, but some of them were indigenous hands. Ben Franklin even wrote about it. They had something figured out that we're still working on, the equal role for women, the long-term thinking, a seat at the table for nature herself. This is great news. This is great news because look, we end this polyamorous crisis situation. Which is really just a narrative battle. It's a battle of stories. And we have this story over here that says, I alone can fix it. This story over here that says, we don't have enough, that we should fear one another, that the only way to exist is on top of someone else, to dominate and extract and destroy in order to exist. That is a lonely path. Because you leave aside all your relations and all your allies. The people moving in that story right now are trying to burn it all to the ground. But here's what they don't know. We here, we earthlings, we people who believe in the full spectrum of life understand the full power of fire to cleanse, to renew, to lay ground for a forest to grow stronger than before. The toxins put off by the systems that are dying are ones that we can compost into something more beautiful. That is our task. They speak of I, we speak of we. They speak of less, we speak of more. We are already doing it. We're seeing languages thought extinct be reawakened. I have seen Appalachia rising, former coal miners now turned into beekeepers, changing their violent relationship with the mountain to one of stewardship. I have heard white ranchers sounding like indigenous people saying, I don't own this land. I'm taking care of it for these birds. The future we want is already here. The story we need, we're embedded within. We must tell it again and again and again. That's how we make things true. That's how we manifest it into being. That's the task. The biggest lie is that there's such a thing as I that's separate from you. Quantum physicists will tell you through and through, we all just energy. An explosion of the Big Bang cruising on waves of cosmic energy from then to now that has never lessened or increased. We are each other. We is just me flipped right side up. Let's get that trending. Tell the story we already know. Listen to and honor those who have been telling it the whole time. Remember, y'all. Renew our commitment to belonging. Remember, we're already doing it. We've already won. Because we exist across this continuum that's never started and never stopped. It just is. Thank you.
Baratunde Thurston, Declarations of Interdependence, a story of storytelling. Executive producer Kenny Ossibel. Written by Kenny Ossibel. Senior producer and station relations Stephanie Welch. Associate producer Emily Harris. Producer Teo Grossman. And I'm host and consulting producer Neil Harvey. Thank you for listening. This is program number 280.
When the white smoke billowed from the chimney in St. Peter's Square, I leaned in towards the television, watching the live announcement of the new Pope. His name is Robert Francis Prevost, announced the RTE correspondent. Scenes of the crowd followed, cheering, crying, waving flags, as a calm man in red robes stepped onto the balcony and gazed down at the people below, and out to the watching world. I turned to my daughter, who was sitting beside me. "I know him," I said. "Who?" she asked. "That priest, the Pope, I know him." And so I began my story. It was September 2004. I had just turned 25 and had flown to Rome with my fiancé to get married at the Pontifical Irish College, a beautiful oasis tucked behind tall black gates on the Via de Santi Quattro. It was a popular place for Irish couples to wed. When we arrived, we were greeted not by the stern, elderly Italian priest, as I had imagined, but by a warm, smiling American with a soft voice. "You can call me Father Rob," he said. He was from Chicago. I was surprised, but pleasantly so. Father Rob welcomed us in, and the ceremony began. Afterwards, we stepped out into the sunlit grounds of the Irish College, where we posed for photos on the stone steps in front of palm trees and lush plants. My parents and new in-laws stood beside us, all of us lining up with Father Rob as the college's resident photographer captured the moment. I wore a simple dress I'd bought from Debenhams in Belfast. I stood there beaming, feeling like my whole life was just beginning. Father Rob walked over to me and leaned in. "So where are you guys going for your wedding dinner?" he asked, glancing towards our chattering parents. "Oh," I said, suddenly realising, there was nothing booked. Yes, unlike many brides who micromanage every detail of their big day, from monogrammed napkins to colour-coded seating charts, I had forgotten to even arrange a wedding meal, completely. Father Rob smiled, then chuckled, and gently placed a hand on my shoulder. "Tell you what," he said, "would you like me to make a call and book somewhere lovely? I know the perfect little place." "Yes, please," I said, flooded with relief. "And how will we get there?" I asked. "Don't worry," he beamed, "I'll take care of everything." The heat was rising and people were starting to get hungry and restless. Then, like a scene from a movie, two sleek black cars pulled up in front of the church and Father Rob extended his arms dramatically. "Your carriages await." We all laughed and climbed in, Father Rob included, and began our drive out of the ancient city. We passed the Colosseum, weaving through the chaotic Roman traffic, and there I was, a brand new bride, on her way to a wedding reception I hadn't planned, all arranged by Father Rob. We left the city and drove up a tree-lined hill, arriving at a beautiful restaurant nestled among Rome's grassy hilltops. Inside, long tables were dressed in starched white linens. Polished silver cutlery and bunches of roses decked the tabletops. We were seated and food began to arrive. Delicious course after course. Cold meat platters with smoked cheese and olives on wooden boards. Fresh pastas, sliced boiled eggs, salads drizzled in local olive oil and grilled fish. This followed by square plates of creamy tiramisu and pear and almond tarts. Red wine and water flowed freely. The room filled with laughter and we ate like kings. I recall the restaurant roof being made of transparent perspex, with water from hose pipes cascading over it to keep the space cool. Father Rob mingled with others in the restaurant and then sat among us, sharing stories of his work in Rome. We exchanged tales of our own lives in Ireland. The high noon sun lowered in the sky. My father paid the bill and we all left happy. When we finally returned to our hotel, my new mother-in-law held onto my arm and said, impressed, "You picked the most beautiful spot for your wedding dinner." I smiled and said nothing. As I told this story, my daughter was listening intrigued. "So that's him?" she asked, clearly amazed, pointing at the television screen as the new Pope stood proud and composed on the Vatican balcony. "That's right," I said. "Father Rob, the priest for my wedding day, is now Pope Leo XIV. Who would have thought?" I rang my parents who were watching the live announcement as well. We had a good laugh, remembering how, on a hilltop in Rome, we'd unknowingly dined with the future Pope. We also joked about how I hadn't even booked a wedding meal. "Some things never change," commented my daughter. 21 years later, 5 beautiful children fill my kitchen with joy and laughter, and I'm also warmed by the memory of a selfless act of kindness. A man who saw a young girl who needed a little help on her wedding day stepped in without drama and simply made everything better, with quiet confidence, genuine care, and a little style. Thank you, Father Rob, or rather, Your Holiness, and congratulations on becoming the new Pope.
We're all familiar with the concept of something being lost in translation, but it's only in the actual act of translation that we understand exactly what it means. Perhaps the phrase lost in translation is itself lost in translation, or at least in banality. When I speak to Italian audiences, I always choose a simple, everyday example. One of my favourites is the expression, ci mancherebbe. You say, ci mancherebbe when someone says thank you, for holding the door open for them, for buying them a coffee, for giving them directions. They say grazie, and you reply, ci mancherebbe. So we know what it means. It's an approximate equivalent of you're welcome or don't mention it. But the Italian phrase has a warmth in its soft chi and a faint lingering on the double B at the end of mancherebbe that your welcome doesn't have. Now, I generally lose Italians at this point because it is, after all, a common everyday phrase for them. They don't think about it any more than we do about our equivalent. Lost in banality, perhaps. The problem for me is that ci mancherebbe cannot be translated literally. It means we would miss it. So I say thank you and you reply we would miss it. It makes no sense in English. And indeed, when you probe it, it makes no sense to Italians either. I remember once asking a translator friend about it and she replied, but it's just the same as figurati. And figurati, which translates as you can imagine or imagine it, is even weirder. Yet it too is an everyday expression. A good Irish example is our phrase, a soft day. What we mean is that it's raining very lightly, or it's humid to the point of being almost raining. It's not cold. It's not that kind of rain that comes with an east wind, which gives rise to the Irish expression, Tashag cur fricana ishkana, it's raining knives and forks. Or as the English would say, it's raining cats and dogs. Though what the cats and dogs have to do with it is anybody's guess. Given English people's devotion to pets, I would have thought raining cats and dogs would be a good thing. Knives and forks, however, is a kind of rain we can feel on our skin. That bitter easterly wind blowing rain cold enough to be hail straight into our faces. But a soft day is a different matter. It may even be a bit close. Another untranslatable expression. Now, how to explain to an Italian that it's a soft day? You can't say una giornata morbida, the direct translation, though you can talk about una giornata dolce, which means a sweet day, but really can't be used to refer to rain. For the Italians, for the most part, rain and humidity mean cold. Perhaps it's a relative thing. In Ireland, if you're used to our winters, a day of light rain with a moderate temperature is surely soft. For an Italian, it's a catastrophe, because the climate is generally much more dolce. So ultimately, it's not complex philosophical or scientific terms which are hard to translate. They have their precise equivalents. It's the simplest phrases, the things we understand instinctively, partly by tone, partly by expression, and partly by context. Another example. I've tried for years to translate an Irish song called An Bhfeidhm Mhara into English. Let's just take the title. An Bhfeidhm Mhara is usually translated as The Mermaid. But what do you think of when you think of mermaids? A woman with a fish's tail? Not useful. Perhaps the Sea Maiden would be a better version, or the Sea Woman, because in the song, the woman has two children. There is, in the three verses we usually hear, no mention of a husband. It's a song that speaks to us directly, like all songs, partly through its beautiful air and partly through the simplicity and directness of the words. In particular, through the direct affection the woman expresses for her children. She calls them, Mavoira Vrinil Isma Fodrig Born. I'm going to pass over the difficulty of rendering that beautiful word brinal into English, beyond saying that it is usually translated as maiden or fair maiden, and I'm going to look at the expression of affection in Padraig Bawn. Bawn, as anyone who speaks even a little Irish will know, literally means white, but here it is an expression of affection. Oscoelge, if you refer to someone as a Buchelbawn or a Collinbawn, you mean a favourite boy or son or a favourite girl or daughter. Hence the name of the Busico play, the Collinbawn. A bawn can also be an unploughed meadow, but that's another story altogether. Now, how do I tell someone that in Irish, to call someone white means to say you love them? It hardly works in this age of white privilege. Yet there it is. A single, simple, beautiful word in a beautiful song that has absolutely no equivalent in the English language. And here I have to say, it is I who am lost in translation.
I remember it clearly. A Friday night in the late 1980s, I got the bus from Dublin to Galway with the firm intention that this was going to be the weekend. I would finally come out to my family and friends back home in the West. But as I travelled through Kildare, Meath, Westmeath, Roscommon and into Galway, that certainty ebbed away. By the time I was home, I no longer felt brave enough to tell my truth. I grew up in the west of Ireland in the 1970s and 80s, a time when the word gay was almost unknown. Queer was the word we used then, and even more undesirable terms. It was a term of abuse, shouted in classrooms and on pitches. In 1986, I moved to Dublin. There weren't many gay places back then, but there were some. It was a clandestine existence for many, where it was not possible to be out at work or highly visible on the street. A time of fear in the gay community. The new disease of AIDS had hit the headlines, and videos of falling tombstones were terrifying all of us young gay men. But over time, like many, I became more comfortable with being gay and expressing that, as part of my life, in Dublin. However, when I went home to the West, I felt the need to hide myself once again. Eventually, I did come out at home in 1993, the same year homosexuality was decriminalised. This was also the year when I first walked in a pride parade in Dublin. There were perhaps 300 people on that parade. We all stood at the top of Parnell Square outside the Garden of Remembrance, on the footpath without disturbing the traffic. Yet we were spotted, and some people covered the eyes of their children and spat at us from buses. As we walked to Collins Street, there were more gay people I recognised watching from the crowd than walking in the march. Like many others, I became an activist to fight for change, ending up as co-chair of the Labour Party LGBT group. In 2007, the government promised to legislate for civil partnership. It was controversial in the gay community. Some saw it as a stepping stone to full equality, while others saw it as continued discrimination. And so, a referendum was promised to change the constitution in order to allow for same-sex marriage. The date was set for 22nd of May, 2015. I voted early that morning at 7 a.m. I was rushing for a train to a wedding in Mayo. Ironically, this was the first civil wedding I had attended in Ireland. A sign of the times, perhaps. It was a joyous celebration of second chances. So many changes in such a short space of time. The following day, I was on the train from Castlebar to Dublin, listening to the radio as the results started to roll in. Dublin Bay South says yes. Loud says yes. Meath says yes. Cork says yes. Yes, yes, yes. County after county. Constituency after constituency voted yes. I travelled once again through Roscommon, Westmeath, Meath, Kildare, and then into Dublin, this journey I had done 1,000 times before. I remembered the day where, travelling in the opposite direction, I'd lost my will and bravery with every stop on the way home, unable to be my true self. But this day was different. This day, as we returned to Dublin, more and more people boarded the train at every station with rainbow flags. An air of celebration and catharsis grew to a frenzy. By the time we arrived at Houston Station, it was like a pride parade. However, this time there weren't 300 people. There were thousands, all walking to one place, Dublin Castle. I walked with them, and we poured into the sunny square and waited for the results to be announced. It felt like the whole country was there. Politicians, celebrities, and all the gay personalities we had ever known. Campaigners and activists, and all those people who thought it would never happen. The journey that day from the west of Ireland wasn't just a train journey. It was a journey through time. A journey from a different place and an utterly different world. From a place which never really felt like home. Never really welcomed us as full citizens, visible and loved for who we are and who we were. No, it wasn't just a train journey. This was a journey home. Finally, we were home. And we all know there's no place like home.
One of my earliest memories is of sitting cross-legged on the floor in my grandparents' sitting room in 1970, waiting for the Eurovision Song Contest to begin. I was 4 3/4 and allowed to stay up very late to see 19-year-old Dana representing Ireland in Amsterdam. For weeks I'd been singing all kinds of everything to my ever-patient granny and grandad, who indulged me every time and sang along. I sat there in front of the telly, a glass of red lemonade and a plate of the good biscuits beside me. Remember the ones with the jelly star on top? My grandparents were my favourite people in the world. I was their first grandchild. The feeling of being adored, safe and loved, that is what I remember most about them. My granny was the boss and she could be a tough cookie, but my granddad adored her and his warm brown eyes lit up any time she walked into the room. I had my own bedroom in their house, a floral landscape of pink and blue wallpaper, a red box record player on the floor, one of those with the lid that turned it into a suitcase, and a small stack of vinyl records that for an almost 5-year-old girl was quite impressive. Joe Dolan's House with the Whitewash Gable was second only to Dana's All Kinds of Everything as my most prized possession. Above the bed was a shelf my granddad had made to allow me to display my collection of tiny dolls from around the world. These little dolls, no more than 4 inches tall, and all in their respective countries' traditional costumes, stood proudly in their tiny plastic cases. France, Spain, China, India, all represented beautifully in miniature. Every Sunday after Mass, Granny would take me to Salmon's on Main Street in Ballinasloe, where she'd buy me either a new vinyl 45 or a miniature doll. For a child in 1970s Ireland, this was indeed a wonderful treat. The dolls from all over the world were allowed downstairs to watch the Eurovision Song Contest that year. After all, they had to see how their own countries fared in the competition. I lined them up along the sofa so they could have a good view of the telly. 19-year-old Dana was the last of the 12 acts to perform that night. She walked out on stage wearing a simple white embroidered mini dress, her long dark hair loose around her shoulders and her brown eyes sparkling. I was enthralled. I remember my granny remarking how she was very composed and didn't look even a bit nervous. Dana perched on a stool. The orchestra played the opening bars and I hardly dared to breathe until she finished the song to rapturous applause. Dana won, of course. The simple ballad All Kinds of Everything became a worldwide hit and the teenager from Derry with the angelic voice became a superstar. Although the Eurovision Song Contest has changed beyond all recognition, it will forever remind me of my granny and granddad that night in March 1970. A nation held its breath for the teenage girl sitting demurely on a stool singing for her country while a 4 3/4-year-old girl sang every word along with her. In later years, of course, Ireland would go on to win the Eurovision 7 times in total, and 10 years later, Johnny Logan became my teenage obsession. Posters of him in his white suit, singing What's Another Year, covered my bedroom walls. The Red Box record player survives to this day. The collection of vinyl records now preserved in frames adorning the walls of my music room. What I wouldn't give for just a brief spin back to Granny's house in the 1970s. Just to hug them both one more time and tell them that I adored them as much as they adored me. And that the love for music they gave me has stayed with me to this day.
It was exactly a decade ago, and I would ask the question of anyone who would listen. What, I would ask, what could be sad about an empty nest? Why isn't the empty nest syndrome a shorthand for joy? I would elaborate that the bird watching websites explained that sometime very early in the morning, when the blue-tit nestlings were coming up to 3 weeks old, they would leave the bird box by the little hole in the front, take their first flight, and never return. They warned me that it would be over in a matter of moments, and I was unlikely to see it for myself. So, it was about 8 in the morning, and I was standing at the kitchen sink, sunlight glancing off the suds, yellow rubber gloves searching the basin for the last things to be washed, when the garden filled up with an exhilarated, insistent, urging birdsong. Yellow gloves held aloft, I ran to the back door to see what the commotion was all about. 1, 2, 3, 4 blue-tit fledglings catapulted from the bird box, somehow knew to fly to the right towards the birch tree, and tumbled down through the twigs and branches until their new claws grasped a perch for the very first time, and they joined the singing. I couldn't smile widely enough to express my joy. As I watched, I remembered the first time I realised in early spring that a pair of blue tits were bringing building materials in and out of what I thought was a garden ornament crudely tied to the fence, but they saw as home. By May, I reckoned the eggs had hatched, and each morning I scanned the sky to see if the parents had survived the night, waiting to see them making their scooping flight across the neighbours' hedges, back to the fence, where they perched above the nest box, checking all round before ducking in the entrance and ducking out again, back and forth, back and forth. As hatchlings turned to nestlings, I would bring my coffee out in the morning sunshine to listen to the peep, peep, peep of the hungry chicks. I was never alone in my vigil. A mischief of magpies lined the roof ridge of the house opposite, one hopping foot to foot with impatience. The neighbourhood cats were attracted to the garden like filings to a magnet, parading the perimeter with predatory intent. And still the busy parents went back and forth, back and forth. All those mornings ago, that exuberant song of those first flights lasted only minutes. And then the garden fell into a deep silence. But the air was still reverberating with hope and promise. How could anyone describe an empty nest with a glum face? Now, this is my first spring as an empty nester myself. The cat now lolls in the hush of my daughter's old childhood bedroom. Yes, there is the joy of watching a young life take shape and find its place in the world, but there's also a counterweight, the ache of missing that trusting little hand in mine, the gentle grief of recognising the changing seasons of my own life, and perhaps, too, a kind of fear. You see, weeks after the nestlings fledged all those years ago, I decided to clean out the bird box in the hope that the next year, another pair of blue tits would make it home. I carefully removed the box from the fence. Opening the bigger door at the back, I could see the carefully woven moss, grass and down that created the soft bed of the nest, and how it was trimmed with a cosy collar of dog hair. As I gently pulled it out of the box and into the light, I saw, cupped at the bottom of the nest, one small, lifeless blue tit, its head turned to one side, a wing extended, with shiny black flight feathers perfectly formed, a bib of yellow fluff on its chest. What had happened to this bird on that glorious early summer morning? As the bird song rang around the garden, why didn't he leave? Did he not understand that call? That it was time to fly, that the nestling had to become a fledgling. Then I better understood the empty nest syndrome. It is the joy, of course. It is the ache of loss. It is the grief of aging. But it's also a kind of helplessness. On that bright June morning, it is the chick alone that can recognize the call to life, and it alone can answer, testing those flight feathers and resolutely flying out into the unknown world.
In 1949, just 4 years after the Second World War, a young German woman from the Rhineland came to Ireland. Her name was Irmgard Kaiser. She met a man from West Cork named Sean O'Hermelty, and they got married a year later in her hometown of Kempen. In 1951, she crossed the Irish Sea once more, expecting a baby. She stepped off the mailboat in Dunleary and made her way up to a red-bricked house in Glenaghiery, number 2 Spencer Villas. She stood in the hallway, just inside the door, and was instantly homesick. This might have been a big mistake, to go and live in a foreign country where everything was so strange. She considered running away, back to Germany, but then she prayed and unpacked her suitcase and got busy. The baby was born in October, a boy. She named him after her father, Franz Kaiser, and from that moment onwards, she knew this was no mistake. She was still homesick, but also very much aware how much you could be made welcome by a child. Her home was where her baby boy, Franz, learned to walk across the kitchen floor. Franzchen, she called him. He was born with a talent for making things right. He picked up those traits that his mother brought with her from Germany, her humour, her storytelling, her ability to put the dark things behind her, that instinctive gift for helping people, what can only be called a conspiracy of kindness. He became a great carpenter. He would arrive with his tools in a homemade trolley pulled at the back of his bike. His work was inventive. Some of the things he assembled could only be called witty. They made you laugh. In a larder in Spencer Villas, there was no space for a large steel pot, so he built a dedicated shelf close to the ceiling, a rounded platform that was more like a lookout tower on the mast of a ship. He solved a leak in the roof by converting a wedding present, an ornamental water feature, into an ingenious cistern, pumping the rainwater away into a gutter. There is a photograph of my brother Franz as a boy at the seafront, wearing German lederhosen and an Irish iron sweater, half German, half Irish. And because we were prohibited by our father from speaking English, only Irish and German allowed in the house, his way of dealing with that confusion was to develop a beautiful formality in English. He would use phrases like, in due course. With regard to that job, I will be able to commence on Monday. He lived his life in translation. He dreamed in German. He sang in Irish. He bought his wood in English. His love of the Irish language began when we were sent to Connemara for 3 months to become fully Irish. He was 10, I was 9. He stayed in the house of the postman in Onchiarurua, and I lived with a family in Ballandangan. We sent each other letters. I went to visit him when I was homesick. I walked into Carrarua and sat with him for a while on the wall of the school, sharing a packet of fruit gums. Chanimid fruit gums the shuppe, agus chahamar tamil a sír a mála lasmud an skoil. Hiúil mé rásca bél an dangan, agus níra mé uignag a hile. When we were small, our mother often rewarded our achievements with a box of Smarties. When he recently had a hip operation, I sent him a WhatsApp message in her words. Ach, Franzchen, jetzt bekommst du eine Packung Smarties. A few days later, I called over to him with a box of Smarties to help him recover. The weather was warm the day he died. He said he never felt better. he had a piece of cake that his sister Ita brought him, and later that evening he went to his singing lesson. He had taken up shannos